Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Cultimatum Podcast, the culture of cults and human trafficking, and my name is Anonymous Andrew, and tonight with me is Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you so much. Today, we are honored to be joined by Jamie Cormier, a former member of the House of Yahweh. Jamie's journey in the cult began in 1996 when she was about 5 or 6 years old, joining alongside her parents. Although I did not know Jamie during my time in the group, we connected through an ex-member support group that I created for ex-House of Yahweh members. Jamie's story offers a compelling perspective, not only on growing up within the cult after polygamy was more prominent, but also as a survivor who's still struggling with having family members still active in the group. We're so grateful to have her here to share her experience with us. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Yes, Jamie, welcome, and thank you for coming on.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
Feel free to start with the beginning, like when and how you joined and what that was like for you at that age and stage in your life.
I don't really remember too much about like the very beginning. It was mainly my dad who like saw the prophetic word program. I'm not sure if you remember that in the day. And a local channel kind of had it on and he saw it. And that was just, he's like, we just need to go here. And so he kind of, that was how it all began. Like it was kind of just someplace we went in the beginning. It was fun as a kid and, you know, everyone was happy and we all got along. And then it just got where there was more rules and just, I don't know.
And when you joined, the polygamy was starting to be fairly common and open. Is that correct?
Yes. I think it had just kind of started out. I want to say
I left in 94 and I left because of the polygamy teaching. So it had started, but I think they were still keeping it pretty hush hush when I left. Even though they kind of technically brought it over the pulpit, they weren't, I just don't think a lot of people were participating. I'm guessing by the time you were there, a lot more people were participating in that practice.
Oh yeah, it was kind of just like the norm growing up. Like some of my friends just, they had two moms or, you know, it was just kind of normal. You didn't think anything of it as a kid because you just, that's how you grow up. So you're just not really thinking that it's not right.
Well, no, as a child, you don't know any.
Yeah.
As children, that's where we get our teachings
from our parents.
Exactly. And so if you grow up in a culture where there's two moms and two dads and or one mom and one dad, whatever. No. A bunch of parents running.
More than one dad.
Yeah, exactly. It would seem normal to you, right? So, you know, so
it was just normal.
Yeah. And then so about what age were you when you started to, maybe the word critical think might be a little premature,
Yeah. I was probably like 15 or 16. And some of my friends were like going through like marriage counseling and stuff like that. And they kind of pushed that. Like when you're a teenager, you go to counseling and it's always, you have to be the perfect like wife. And they're like, it's all about that. Like, the women take care of the men and you have to listen to your dad or your husband or whatever man is over you. Like you just had to sit there and be quiet. You didn't have a voice. You didn't have anything. Like, you did what you were told, and that was that. And so there just was 15, nothing else.
You were getting counseling to be a wife, even if you weren't betrothed to be married to anybody at age 15?
Yeah, you had, like, counselors and stuff like that. And, like, you went through, like, a program almost. It was called, I forgot what it's called, but there was, like, a book, like, betrothal counseling or something like that. So even you weren't, I'm sorry.
No, so they're grooming you. Grooming.
Exactly. Yes. Like, no, even though I wasn't, like, betrothed to anyone, like, basically, like, you're taught that that's your purpose in life, basically. That's your only purpose, is that.
Wow. Which I, you know, we've been doing this now 8 months maybe, and we're 50-something episodes in, and every time I hear this, it's still disgusting to me that they treat women like this. It's just...
No, yeah. I still have a lot of, like, after effects of it. Like, I'm a very strong, independent person right now, and it is very hard for me to give up any kind of control over myself and my life just because of how much control I had to give up, you know, as a young adult. It is just so hard for me.
You must have been quite the rebeller back then. Did you get in trouble?
Yeah. Honestly, I was a perfect child. Like, I never spoke out. I would get in trouble because I would try to, like, speak up with my dad especially. And he would always get angry with me. Like, you weren't allowed to have an opinion. You weren't allowed to have a voice. You weren't allowed to have feelings. Like, that just wasn't a thing. So you just bottle it all up. And you know what happens when you bottle everything up and it comes to the surface. So,
right. So I'm sure that's a trauma response to what you have now and feeling that you don't want anybody to control anything.
It's very explosive. Like, when I feel the slightest bit controlled, I tend to kind of explode. And it's definitely a trauma. Definitely.
Yes.
It's not something good. I've gone through counseling and it's not something fun to deal with at all.
So maybe I'm jumping ahead, but so at 15, you're attending these grooming classes, or do you call them counseling?
It was called counseling, yeah. That's what I called it, counseling sessions.
Did you ultimately find a man and marry him?
No, I never did. I was lucky. Like, my dad never had a second wife. He never pursued that. That just wasn't where his mind was. Thankfully, and we didn't have a lot of money and we lived out of town. So it just wasn't something that he had pursued. Thankfully, I mean, you know, that's one good thing about it. He didn't push us to get married or anything like that. Like, if that's something that we wanted, then that was fine. And he had us go through the counseling just to kind of save face, I guess you could say. And then we got baptized and all that stuff. And I just remember it was just hard because we did live out of town. So we'd go there 3 times a year for feasts. And you just had to put on, like, this show almost. And so you were never yourself. You were always this, like, fake person. You were who they wanted you to be. And I remember
I can totally relate to that, Jamie. I say all the time about, like, even my marriage within the House of Yahweh, that we married cult versions of each other.
Yes. You're not yourself.
So we didn't each other were. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. And that in itself, that's like, it's such a horrible feeling to feel like that. Like, you have to always be fake. It's horrible. And then the clothes they make you wear, literally you can't even show your ankles. You have to wear skirts to the floors and long sleeve shirts. And there was, like, purity laws. So, like, if you're a female and you were on your period, like, you were basically apart from your friends, from the congregation, like, you were separated. You couldn't be together. It was just like you were almost exiled.
Wait a minute. How would they know that you were menstruating?
They made us wear, like, masks and gloves and long sleeve shirts. And you had to sit on mats. They had this whole thing, like, they were called purity.
You had to use separate bathrooms, separate showers.
Everything was separated. So you had three. It was basically like flowing. And then you were counting. And then you were clean. And you were separated into those three categories as a female. You went through a different door. You had to wear gloves and masks, like surgical masks or veils. We called them veils. Basically, the women were covered from head to toe, basically.
So when your cycle began, you basically had to divulge that.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, because otherwise...
You were supposed to.
Yeah. I mean, because I know the human body, there's no telltale sign that you're menstruating other than you're bleeding, right? And that's covered with clothes.
Yeah. So it was up to you.
And I'll tell you,
to wear the mask, wear the gloves, wear the long sleeve shirts, because
yes,
you could basically contaminate someone else who was clean.
Oh, yes.
You were considered, basically you were treated like a leper. A leper.
Yeah.
And and that started when I was still there, and they had, I don't know if they still did this, in the shower rooms, they had black shower curtains for the showers that they still, menstruating women had to use the showers with the black shower curtains. And I still remember my sister's like, my sister was like, I'm not using that black shower curtain. I don't think it's anybody else's business that I'm on my period.
Did anybody have a clue that this horrible. Is part of human biology? That this is how for 500,000 years, the man and woman walked the earth. This is what the woman goes through every month, and it's natural.
It literally made you feel like you had a disease. For 2 weeks out of the month, you were diseased. You couldn't sit at the same table and eat with your friends, with your mom, with your sister. You literally were exiled.
But what are you going to contaminate? I'm sorry. Melody knows I get really like riled up when I hear this crap. It's just.
And this is a new part of the story that Andrew, I think, has not heard before.
Every time we have a House of Yahweh guest, I learn more. It's holy shit. I'm sorry.
I like the shock factor.
There's so much. There's so many things you can't even like get into all of it. I know my last
piece, you're right.
When I was like, I've had enough with this place. This place isn't the true place. Is I had started working when I was 18 years old. Because that's what you do. When your parents don't have a lot of money and you want to get your driver's license and all this stuff, you get a job. So I started working with my mom at the local newspaper in the town that we lived in. And I started hanging out with people my own age. And, you know, it's fun. And you have friends that are normal, like real normal. And your whole new world is opened up to you. And I remember I would go to the feast and I would just pretend. I would save face. I would be the best, most righteous daughter of Yahweh that I could be. And inside my heart, I just wasn't there. And I remember thinking that if I got like anointed or whatever as deaconess, because you know how you have the elders, and then when you're a female, you're a deaconess. So they called my name as a deaconess. And I remember when I heard my name being called, in my mind, my initial thought was, this place is absolute bullshit, 100% bullshit. Because if the creator is really making these decisions, then he knows in my heart that I'm not righteous. And in my heart, I'm not really in it. So he would have never made me a deaconess. He would have never gave me a position in this place if he really was real.
So your critical thinking started kicking in, because that's exactly what that's all about. You're starting to question what the teachings of what they're teaching you just didn't align with rationale.
Yeah, it didn't. Not at all. Not at all. It wasn't rational. Not even a little bit rational.
Just as a side note, what state were you brought up in?
I live in Louisiana.
Yeah, I could tell. I love your accent.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, this is just blows my mind that this whole thing goes on with the separation of the women and the men, and then it was hard. So you said earlier that today you're an independent woman and you can't be controlled. I'm saying that in a good way. But at what age at some point that must have conflicted with you? 15, 16, 17 is when your mind and personality is really developing, mm-hmm. right? So maybe I'm jumping ahead, but at what age did you really begin to start questioning all of this?
Probably around 17, 18. It was around the time that I had gotten my job. And they call it your worldly job. Like, this is your job in the world. And you're supposed to work to pay tithe to the House of Yahweh. And you give your tithe for the work. You basically have a worldly job to support the work. So whenever I started working in the world, that was when, in my 18-year-old mind, I was like, everything that I ever thought was true and real isn't. It's not. Like, they tell you that the worldly people are evil and, you know, heartless, and that just wasn't true at all.
I got a question. So, and this is to both of you, because you're both House of Yahweh, X. And so I'm worldly because I'm not a cult member. I wasn't in the House of Yahweh. So if we're so bad and so evil and so whatever, but you can come work for us? See where I'm going there?
Yeah.
there was a few years where they made mistakes. So you had to redo third tithe year too. Oh, it wasn't last year. Yes. It's really this year. So we had to give 30% multiple years in a row.
Yeah. But you got no refund.
No.
That because they did the math wrong. Because same thing for me. I was only in for 5 years, but we did third tithe 3 times in 5 years. The math doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. The math doesn't math.
And what happens if you say no? Like, I did pay it last year, because obviously they're strong arming you into giving more.
You would basically like get ostracized, basically. Like, you're not part of us. You don't believe.
And you would get it in counseling too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. Counseling was a big thing. And if you were not doing everything you were supposed to do, you get fussed at, basically.
I just find it so hypocritical that, and I know it's not just this cult, many cults, they kept to themselves and they had this whole little world going on, and you couldn't socialize with the worldly people. You couldn't date outside your cult, but you could go work for somebody else. Is that hypocritical?
It's that basically like do as I say, not as I do.
Yep. Okay.
I'm just going to back up a little bit in your story, Jamie, because I think, and I suspect this from other ex-members that I've spoken to, that sometimes the getting ordained thing, getting ordained a deacon, a deaconess, elder, whatever it may be, sometimes they will do that to people that they fear are getting ready to fall away or starting to doubt. And I think they do it to try to pull them back in because they are hoping that they will be tempted by the power of the position. And so they may have actually seen that you were not, they might have seen some doubt in you. Yeah. And that may have been why they tried to pull you back in with that anointed, what do you call it?
Position. So, and that could be true.
So they may have sensed that you were beginning to critically think, and that they pulled you back in by anointing you deaconess.
Yeah, I mean, it could very well have been the case because, like I said, I was working in the world. I did start wearing worldly clothes whenever I wasn't there, you know, and you start questioning, like in your counseling sessions and stuff, you'll start to have questions that you never had before. So probably in their mind, they're like, what's going on here? And then if you're 18 and you're still not questioning marriage, like I still never, ever, not one time asked to actually be married. I just went through the counseling just because it was something you did. But I never asked to actually go through and get married ever, not one time.
I kind of know the protocol or policies, but were you at 15, 16, 17, just because you're a young adolescent and your hormones are spinning, because it's natural to be curious about boys and boys curious about girls. Did you have a crush on a guy? Did you want to date somebody?
I never was around boys ever.
Really?
By the time I was that age, everything was completely separated. There was a wall up. Probably when I was like 14 or 15, there was a wall up in the sanctuary. And even at our local elder's house for services, there was a curtain. Like in the room, there was a curtain. The men went in one door, the women went in the other door. So I was never around boys ever.
And that's by design, Andrew.
And I get that. But we've heard in other stories from either this cult or other cults that the adolescents, the teenagers, got around that by sneaking around or passing notes or so. I'm just wondering if you didn't.
Well, I didn't grow up there. And we were
homeschooled. That's right.
We were homeschooled. So like, I was only around the people that my parents brought me around.
Okay.
So I didn't have like a social life until I started working when I was 18. And then I started getting a social life.
I'm sorry to keep hopping on this, but I'm just curious, at what point did you become interested in boys?
Once I started working in the world.
Okay.
Yeah, like she was around him. It wasn't a thing for me. Because I wasn't around them.
And I'm just going to, for the audience sake, I'm going to give a little insight here that on my perspective, I believe that the reason that this was done, meaning the walls and the curtains and the separating of the boys and the girls, was because the older elders did not want the young women and the young men to see each other because it would be natural that they would be attracted to each other.
Thank
and
you.
And the old men... And the old men wanted first dibs on all the young women, and they didn't want the competition of the young, healthier men.
Yeah, because I didn't even know they existed, really. Like, I was literally surrounded by females, pretty much from the time I was 13, 14, 15 years old until I started working at my job. I didn't even know how to talk to boys.
Did you have any siblings, brothers?
I have a sister.
Sister, okay.
I have a twin sister. So I didn't even have brothers. And then like some of my friends had brothers, but we didn't hang out with them. I was only allowed to hang out with the girls. We didn't hang out with the boys. It was completely separated.
That's just so cruel. Biologically, they were built. I don't even know.
It stunts your emotional growth.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
It really does.
Yeah.
It really does. It's just, I don't know. It's just hard. It's hard to, I guess, none of us are really normal. Like, there is no sense of that word, but it's really hard to be a normal, functioning human.
Teenager.
Yeah. It's just, it's really hard when everything's just so separate.
Okay. So you're 18 and you're working at a worldly company. And I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask, like, so when and how did you ultimately end up leaving? And is your family, I know they're still in, but do they actually live in the cult in Abilene now, or are they still in Louisiana as well? How did that all play out for you?
When COVID started, they relocated to Texas. They were told it was basically COVID was going to end the world and they needed to go to the safe place. So they relocated to Texas after COVID started. Like right at the very beginning of COVID, they had moved. So they haven't lived in Louisiana since 2020.
So, and had you already left?
I had already left, yes. I left when I was almost 19. My last feast was Tabernacles, which was in the end of the year. I was 18 and then I never went back. Passover would have been the next feast and that would have been in March or April. And I never went back. I left in like February. My grandma always had like an open door policy. My mom's mom, she always had an open door policy. They never changed their phone numbers. And both of my grandparents, they never changed their phone numbers. They kept their same numbers as long as I've been alive, if not longer, just because they always wanted to have a way for us to contact them. So my grandma always said, whenever you're ready, call me and I'll be there. And I called her and literally the next day she came get me and my clothes.
So
and
I'm guessing.
They were not.
And they handled that perfectly, beautifully.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what you should do when you have a family member who's in a cult
always
is leave that door open.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm glad that worked out for you. So you at 19, you left literally. And so where did your grandparents live?
They live here. They live in Louisiana too. They live like a few towns over. One of them lived down the street and the other one lived a couple towns away.
All right. So you left Abilene and traveled to Louisiana at 19 mm-hmm. to live with your grandparents?
No, we always lived in Louisiana. We lived in Louisiana.
Okay, right.
Texas.
Yeah. All right. When COVID hit, they went to Texas, but you stayed in Louisiana. Okay.
I stay here. I've always lived in Louisiana. Louisiana's home.
Okay.
So my question for you then is, because I kind of know their policies, when you left and you're now living with your grandparents, I'm going to assume at this point you were excommunicated even from your parents and your sister who lived still close by.
It was supposed to be, but my mom always kept contact, always, until she had her stroke 2 years ago. She had a stroke and my dad found out that she had kept communication and he cut all ties completely whenever he found all that out, had her phone shut off and just made it to where no one could talk to her at all.
It's horrible. But
up until then, she always kept contact with me, always. She would text me, she would call me whenever she could. She always had a job, always. A worldly job, you know. They tell you, don't quit your day job, basically, because they still need that money coming in. So even when they moved, she always worked, always. So, you know, she would always have a way to contact me because she wasn't always in their sights, basically. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. And that's probably why it's so hard these last 2 years not being able to just have that contact with her.
Do you know if she's still working or did her strokes prevent her from being able to work anymore?
Her stroke prevented her from being able to do a lot of things, from what I understand. I haven't been able to speak with her or anything like that. Her mom has spoken to her a couple of times because we would call the local police and do wellness checks and things like that. But even that kind of came to a halt because the elder that's affiliated with the sheriff's department in the town, he told everyone that they moved back to Louisiana to be with family. And that's just not true. So we have no way to contact her at all. And we can do wellness checks and stuff like that, but they're told that they moved. So there's really not too much that the local sheriff's department can even do anymore when they're being told, oh, they're not here anymore. They're not here.
And just for curiosity's sake, I will mention for anybody listening that listened to episode number 51, Leanne's episode, the person that Jamie is referring to that is doing this is closely associated with the sheriff's department is Leanne's
ex-husband.
Yes. So there is connection there that's, I just thought anybody who's listening might, heard Leanne's episode might find that interesting.
Yeah. It's her ex-husband that puts that wall between, because he's affiliated with the local sheriff's office in that town.
Can I ask how he's affiliated?
I don't know the details of that. Whenever I call to speak with the sheriff's office, they always are like, well, we have to call that person. I don't want to mention any names or anything like that. But I've always been told that they need to contact him specifically and speak with him about the matter because he's there. I'm not quite sure the terminology.
I think liaison.
Yeah. Basically, because they have to keep like an open connection or something like that for certain reasons. I'm not really sure all the terminology and legalities and all of that. I'm not really sure about that.
Not 100% sure, but I will say what I've heard, which is that he went through some sort of like training to become training. Like a sheriff or a deputy or something. And that I think that the town was not too happy about the idea of him being an out and out sheriff. So I think they gave him this liaison position to where he kind of knows the laws of the land. And then he kind of communicates between law enforcement and the rest of the cult, basically, is my understanding.
That's my understanding as well. I'm not sure, like I said, all the legal terms and all of that, but that's my understanding too. He's basically the wall in between, basically.
So they had kind of like an insider at the police department.
Yes. He's their insider. Yeah. So every time you call to get a wellness check on someone, they call him and they're like, well, we don't have any reason to believe that he would not be telling us the truth. Well, he's a cult leader. So of course he wouldn't be telling you the truth,
but
that's just, you know, my feelings on the situation.
Oh, I'm sure you're spot on.
No, I agree. And I think that part of the reason that they probably agreed to even have a liaison officer with the cult in general is because I think there was a great amount of fear and tension between the rest of the community and the cult, and they just didn't like the idea of having to go inside the gates and do any of these things like welfare checks or any of those things. They just don't want to be responsible for any of that.
They don't want to open that door for any outsiders at all. I think they're pretty closed off these days because there has been a few incidences where people do get inside the gates with cameras and stuff like that. So I think they're very closed off now, a lot more closed off than they've ever been.
Yeah, I agree.
When you say get in with cameras and, well, like press or...
There's been a few cases where like reporters and stuff will get in there pretending to be new members. There have a few, like if you look on YouTube and stuff like that, there's a few things where they've gotten in. So they're just very closed off now. I don't think they're accepting any new members, to be honest.
That was the last I heard too. I think they're just really untrusting.
Yes.
So, and I actually, not only are they not accepting new members, but my understanding is that they are having a great exodus of all the young people that as soon as they turn of age, a lot of people are turning 18 and they are out the door. And the ones that aren't are telling their parents when they're 15, 16, 17, as soon as I'm 18, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised because we see that in the Amish. We see that in a lot of the other cults. And my guess or my take on that is, like in Jamie's case, she was working in a worldly business and she saw the rest of the world. She saw cell phones and social media and boys and realized that your cult was...
They basically lie to you.
You're right. And they're separating you. And all of a sudden you're out in the worldly world and you're seeing how much fun all these teenagers are having. They're going to movies, they're going out partying or having date night, whatever. And it's going to draw the young members of this cult and many cults out the door.
Absolutely. And then ironically, they don't treat you like a leper 2 weeks of the month.
No,
you're just a normal person.
Yeah, imagine that.
Well, you're just a normal human being. And you learn that people are not evil and they're not hateful. And, you know, they care just as much as anyone else. And you have friends and you have, you know, people that become your family, and you're not ostracized. And, you know, you don't have to worry about what you say or what you do or what you wear. You can just be yourself.
And what teenager would not want that lifestyle? Like,
yeah, exactly.
You have to wear those black dresses and veils and to see that. This is the point that I was getting at earlier about when you're 15, 16, 17, it's natural for an adolescent teen, male or female, to be curious about the opposite sex or even the same sex. It doesn't matter. It's just you're curious about sex. You're curious about biology. Mm-hmm. But when you're shielded from that, but then you're exposed to it when you go to these worldly jobs.
You tend to go a little crazy.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it probably makes you more curious.
Yeah.
It probably actually creates the opposite effect of what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, it is. Because like I partied and I did some stuff that I probably shouldn't have done. And I did go a little crazy and I ended up pregnant at a younger age than I would have liked. You know, I love my kid. I have a 12-year-old and, you know, I love her. I wouldn't change that, you know. If I wouldn't have did what I did, I wouldn't have her. And it put me in a relationship for 10 years that, you know, I probably, if I had grown up differently, I probably would have realized it wasn't the healthiest relationship for me.
Jamie, worldly people do that too. Don't beat yourself up over that. There's plenty of us worldly people who make mistakes. And, you know, I had a third child out of wedlock and the sky didn't come crashing down.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that you do learn. Like, you do all these things and you don't get hit by lightning and you,
right.
You know, you don't, nothing really happens. It's your own mistakes and you just learn. And it's just really hard. And it's a really shocking all at once, I guess, to just come from being so sheltered and then just to be out in the open. It's a really shocking experience.
So I'm curious, you had a child at what age?
I was 21. I had just turned 21.
And the man that you met was worldly?
Yes.
Okay.
He was worldly and he was 10 years older than me.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I was 20 and he was 30.
And you stayed with him for 10 years?
For 10 years. We were together for 10 years.
And
just shy of 10 years.
Who walked away from who?
I decided that it just wasn't healthy.
Okay. Good for you.
Yes. Yeah. Good for you. Yep, just like you walked away from the house of Yahweh when you decided that wasn't healthy.
Yeah.
So do you want to share with our audience like where you are today and in your deconstruction and how that's going for you?
I just try to take life every day, like every day at a time, one day at a time. You get up, you go through the motions, you know, get my kid up, get her to school. I go to work. I'm a warehouse manager at a local grocery store. I'm about to have my 11-year anniversary over there. So I just try to be as normal as possible. And I, you know, have gone through therapy and I've done a few things and recognized that I do have like depression and anxiety and a lot of things that I just have to deal with like anyone else. And you just day by day, one day at a time.
Yeah. Again, us worldly people have depression and anxiety and yeah. Welcome to the reality.
It's normal.
Yeah.
It's just normal.
Jamie, is there a new man in your life at all?
Yeah. I've been with the guy I'm with. We're going on 5 years. Yeah. So, no, he's good. He's good. He puts up with me. It's definitely not easy, but he does it.
Does he have a child?
No, he doesn't have. Yeah, we just have one kid. I was a one and done.
Okay.
I'm going to assume that, I mean, I hope for your sake that maybe somehow, some way your mom might listen to this podcast. I don't know how and why and in what world, but if she is listening, is there anything you want to say or a message you'd like to kind of send out to her in case she finds this by some miraculous miracle?
I just would want her to know that I love her and I always love her. And I just want her to be okay. And I'm not mad at her or, you know, she just did the best that she could. And she was married to my dad and she wanted to follow my dad. You know, you follow your husband and that's what she did. And that was what was right for her. And, you know, I'm not angry about it. It is what it is. And I love her. And I just want to talk to her.
Do either of your mom or dad know that they have a grandchild?
Yes. My mom has hung out with her and spoken with her. My dad has never uttered not one word to my child. My child thinks that he hates her. She asked me all the time, why do we never talk to him? He was literally in my apartment and he never said two words to my kid a few years ago. It was a big thing. It was a really big thing. It was very traumatic for my kid.
All right.
And there's a lot.
So I have to ask. So have you sat down with your daughter and explained your involvement in the House of Yahweh and how all this played out?
Some stuff I have told her, but I just still feel that she's too young and I just don't want all of that in her head. Maybe when she's a little bit older, I'll tell her the whole of it. But as of right now, I just want her to be a kid.
Yeah.
I didn't get to be a kid. And she already has to deal with me and her dad not being together. And there's some tension there. So I just want her to be a kid and I want her to be herself. And so as of right now, I haven't told her the whole story about how I grew up.
It's a personal question.
Story.
Does she get to see her dad?
Yeah. We have 50-50 custody.
Okay.
Yeah, we share 50-50 straight down the middle. So she sees us both an equal amount.
Okay. Yeah, that's good.
So I guess my next step and kind of wrapping up, Jamie, would be if you had a message to anybody who might be thinking about joining a group or is in a group and wanting to get out, what would be your best words of advice to give somebody who might be in a similar situation that you were in?
Just follow your gut. If you feel that it's not right, then it's probably not right. If you're unhappy, if you are doubting, then like just know that there's always going to be someone outside of that group that's going to be there for you. Like, just don't feel like you're alone because you're not. You're never alone.
I love that.
And with the internet today and with podcasting and social media, and there's a lot of resources for ex-cult members today. So, as opposed to 10 years ago, like when Melody got out, she didn't have any of that today. But Melody, when she could, she started her Facebook group. And that's what I'm getting at, is that there's resources today for people who are the 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds who are leaving, but they were there since they were 1, 2, or 3. They still have all this stuff in their head that they were taught and they need to deconstruct. And and I think you said you go to therapy?
I've done it a few times. It's hard to find a therapist that
specializes in this.
Yes, it's hard. I feel not understood and it kind of causes a barrier. And it's just hard to open up to someone that you just feel doesn't understand your situation. I mean, they do the best they can. It's not their fault. It's just hard to find someone that understands it, that specializes in this.
Because
it is a different type of trauma.
Absolutely.
So it's way different.
Oh, go ahead, Andrew.
It's a completely new field in the therapeutic world. When somebody goes to school for psychiatry or to become a therapist, whatever they decide, you know, master's in social work and whatever, they probably don't teach this stuff because it's not mainstream.
It's out of the box.
Exactly. It's just now in 2025, because of this podcast and many others like it and many Facebook groups and many websites, it's just now coming to light about the trauma that many cult survivors have gone through or are going through. And I hope that the universities or whatever who are teaching are the therapists that are, you know, some of them may not realize in this, but at least they can get some education in it. So if somebody like you walks through the door, they know how to help you.
Yes. I would like to believe with all the documentaries and the publicity that cults are getting these days that they are going to start teaching this part of college for therapists and psychiatrists to be able to specialize in cult recovery type therapy. Yeah. I think that should be a specialized field for people to work in. 100%.
Very helpful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that was helpful to you. And you can see I've branched out since then and have the whole escape and recovery group now. And I've got the podcast. And I'm glad that is helping, because that was exactly my intention, is because I had that same feeling of just like nobody understands what I've been through. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, the only people who would are other ex-members. And so I'm like, well, how could I get them all in one place? Yeah. How could we help each other?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's amazing. You feel like you're on an island alone, and then that door opened up and you're like, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
I would like to think that, see, I come from the world, Jamie doesn't know this, but I'm a recovering alcoholic. So I come from a world where there's these self-help groups. So the only person who can really help another alcoholic is another alcoholic. So
yep, exactly.
I'm wondering if maybe some support groups are popping up around the country for cult survivors who can get together. You know, I mean, Facebook is great and it's online, but
face to face.
Yeah. I'm just thinking somebody could start a in-person support group where you can go once or twice a month or once a week or whatever. And
no, that would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know there is one in Michigan, but it's in Grand Rapids, which is like a 3-hour and 45-minute drive for me. Mm-hmm. That's a long way to go for us.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I love the idea of it. If there was one closer, I would certainly be part of it because I think it would be helpful.
There could be some on Zoom. You know, after the pandemic, many, many support groups, including AA and all the 12-steppers and a lot of support groups went online and stayed online. So I wonder if you Google cult surviving support group or something, you might find something. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm sure.
Okay.
There used to be one. I don't know if there is still one, but I'll give them a little plug here. Vashti Initiative website used to have one. I know because I used to help facilitate that group. I don't know if they're still doing that. The last I knew, they were still doing that.
Yeah.
So, but it's, I like it. And maybe it's something I should take into consideration as part of even the Cult Escape and Recovery Group, having a weekly or monthly support group of some sort, because I think it would be helpful.
Yeah, definitely. It'd be very helpful, I'm sure. I know I would definitely sign up for that.
Well,
I'm gonna put that on my list of things to do.
Jamie, any last thoughts before we say goodbye?
Just for anyone out there listening, like you're not alone. So don't feel like you're alone. I know being in a cult in a situation like that, it's very isolating. But just know that you, no matter how isolated you feel, there is always someone out there that will be willing to help. Always.
I love that, Jamie, because if you listen to our podcast, the tagline that I always end the show with is, as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.
Yeah.
That is how we end every podcast episode. So I love that. I think that's perfect. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your experience with us today. We appreciate you.
Yes, thank Jamie. You. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And once again, we want to thank Jamie so much for coming on the show and sharing her experience with us. Wow. Andrew, I love the shock factor.
Yeah.
When you find all these new things about my cult, because it's just, there's so much, right? There's so much weird shit. Let's just say it like it is.
And then of course, once we stop recording, Jamie dropped a bunch of new stuff about the cult, and then you two were talking. Jamie said something about people, the younger generations, all they're leaving in flocks, and I'm so happy to hear that. I really,
me too.
Because it's,
me too.
At some point, all these elders are going to be standing around one day going, where is everybody? There's going to be like, 150, 25, and then one day there's going to be like five of them, and that could be a decade down the road, but I think the House of Yahweh and some of the other ones,
yes,
their time has come. The time has come.
I have heard that too. And I think that, I don't think that the House of Yahweh is the only cult being affected by that. The younger generation having more potential exposure to that critical thinking.
How can it not with social media? Because once they get, I get that they're sheltered when they're in. Like if they're in the community and they go to these festivals. But what really shocked me, and I'm happy for it, is that they allow them to go work in the worldly world.
Right.
Where do you think they're going to get? They're going to get exposed to the worldly world. Yeah. And these young kids are going to see social media. They're going to see.
Yeah, I think actually a lot of them aren't working in the worldly world right now. But I do think word has gotten around and they are aware of phones and technology and all that other stuff. So they're still getting that exposure somewhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You can't put somebody in a bubble.
And the same thing's
going to
happen. No. And I always use the Amish as an example, but it's just a matter of time. And the Amish actually let them, what is it, Ramhausen? Yeah. They let them go out for a year. Yeah, I always get that wrong. They let them go out for a year. And I think I'd love to see the stats on how many actually come back, because I think you're going to see the Amish slowly disappear. Although I know they're all over the country, but
right,
the younger kids are just going to, they're going to go out and go, wait a minute, this is better than where I'm, you know, whatever.
Exactly, exactly. So, they're going to want that better life. So once again, we do want to thank Jamie for coming on the show. And we want to thank all of you for tuning in to Cultimatum. Your support is always greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, we would greatly appreciate it if you could rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can find us on additional social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cults or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And for ex-cult members, if you are in need of any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
You can also check out my other podcast, the Digital Dating Podcast with Anonymous Andrew. I'd like to help with the cost of maintaining the podcast. You can show your support through the Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in the show notes. It's simply a little link. You click on it and you can donate $5 or $10 to the show, because right now we don't have any advertisers or sponsors, and there is a cost in maintaining this. So anything you can do helps us with our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.